Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking nearly 50 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your guest host, Annie Feit. Soccer, basketball, skiing, hockey, swimming, running. Kids in Alaska have so many options when it comes to sports. And the benefits go way beyond fitness. Confidence, friendships, time away from screens. But to keep participating, kids need to stay healthy, physically and mentally. Today, we're talking about how to make that happen. My guests have a lot of wisdom on this. Holly Brooks is a former Olympic cross-country skier, coach, and now a mental health therapist who works with athletes. Susanna Rogers is a sports physical therapist and owner of Runner's Edge Clinic here in Anchorage. And Alyssa Horn is a former professional basketball player turned strength and conditioning coach for kids and adults. She's the owner of the Sweat Lab Gym. I should mention this is a pre-recorded show, so you won't be able to call in with questions, but we're glad you're with us. And let's start by having each of you introduce yourself a little bit more. Holly, let's start with you.
Yeah, my name is Holly Brooks, and I was a full-time coach. I was the ski coach at West Anchorage High School and then at APU Nordic Ski Center. That led me down a circuitous path to being an Olympic athlete. Usually people are an athlete and then a coach, but I did the reverse. And then today I am a mental health therapist that specializes in working with athletes. And I often say that my passion is sustainability in sport. I have lots of passions around that space. I should mention I'm also a parent of 2 8-year-olds and a volunteer coach as well for spider soccer and, you know, other things as well. So thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks for being here. And Susanna, how about you?
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Susanna Rogers, and I have been a sports physical therapist for 23 years, I think, if my math is right. And I do own Sports Physical Therapy Clinic in Anchorage, Runner's Edge, Alaska, and we specialize in getting our clients back to whatever they want to do outside in the mountains and all the sports endeavors. And truly, my passion has been getting kids and young adults reach their physical goals as safely, as effectively as possible. I can also mention that I have 2 kids there. My older one is not a teenager anymore, so we've gone through the sports and you name it, growth and development with them. And I also volunteer with the U.S. National Ski Team as a sports physical therapist. And I cover the big competitions like the Olympics, our World Championships, and so on. Super happy to be here, and I'm excited with our conversation takes us.
Thank you. And Alyssa, how about you?
Hi, Annie. Thanks so much for having me. And hello, Alaska. This is an awesome opportunity. I'm really excited to be in the room with these 2 amazing ladies. A little bit about me. I'm from Kodiak, Alaska originally. My family is also Aleut, so I got some native blood in me. I'm the outlier here. I do not have children nor plan to, so I can provide some, I guess, anti-perspective to the conversation a little bit. My business is called Make Yourself. I've been in business for about 9 years doing basketball development and basketball camps around the state, as well as strength and conditioning here in town. And I just love it. I love working with kids and adults, and just am so fortunate to do that.
Great. Thanks for being here. And Susanna, can you just start by talking about what are the most common injuries in kids that you see in your clinic?
Great question. And I think the way to answer it is maybe twofold. It really depends on the season. And right now, we are at beginning of May, at late April, beginning of May, where we see a lot of injuries related to track and field. So when we see high school and middle school sports, they start really quickly, you know, after winter of not doing much. So we see a lot of maybe anterior knee pain, shin splint type injuries that can potentially develop into bone stress injuries. And then we also see injuries that are kind of the remnants of the winter because the skiing is still really good and competition's almost over. So the kids go and have fun. So we can see ACL injuries related to spring skiing.
What is an ACL injury?
ACL injury is the anterior cruciate ligament of the knee, and it's one of the most common ligamentous ruptures that we see. Its job is stabilize the knee in the front and back direction. It's pretty devastating injury because when it happens, when a person injures their ACL, many times people go into surgical reconstruction. They can take up to a year to get them back to their sports, back to competition. But also we see some people that choose not to get it repaired. You don't have to have it repaired and do just fine.
And is there an age range where you tend to see more injuries in kids?
Yes, and this is actually a really interesting topic. And I would start talking about the maturation versus chronological age. And we all notice kids develop in different speeds, right? We see somebody who may develop really quickly and they look mature at a very young age. They're called the early maturers. And then we see kids that are not developing as quickly, and they might look like they're still a kid and they might be 16, 17 years old. So the injuries that we see in these two populations are a little different. With the early maturers, girls maybe age 12 to 14, kind of the early adolescents, we see a lot of like patellofemoral pain, which is front of the knee pain pretty much. We can see a lot of ACL injuries in skiing and soccer, for example, or cutting sport, like basketball and volleyball. And then with the late maturers, we might see more bone stress injuries because that is related to maybe their sport.
Okay. And what is early sports specialization and why does it make kids more prone to injuries?
Great question. And, I was thinking, when I was getting ready for our conversation, I was thinking about this topic because it's a big topic. And early sport specialization in its true sense is when you have a kid, a young teenager, or even before that, just doing that one sport. And I don't want to single out certain sports, but maybe we can look at like gymnastics or ballet, where kids start gymnastics very young, and that's all they do because it takes a lot of their time and their parents' time to get them to gymnastics gym. So that is the true sport specialization when they just do one sport and they might do it most of the year. When we look at it from like physical therapy, medical perspective, the young body gets stressed in the ways that is not very favorable to injury prevention and like growth and development. So for example, in gymnasts, we see growth plate injuries in the wrist because they do a lot of the pounding on their upper body, for example. So then we can talk about early sports specialization when we talk about maybe hockey or basketball or sports that you can play year-round. And we see injuries related to growth plate where the tendons and muscles attach to the bone because of the cutting and jumping nature of the sport. On the other hand, if we talk about maybe like downhill skiing or cross-country skiing, which is my area of expertise, even if the kid signs up to do, let's say, cross-country ski club that can run year-round, I don't think that is early sports specialization in their true sense because we will have many different aspects of different sports in their prep. So they might do a lot of sports that involve hand-eye coordination, ball sports, jumping, plyometrics, endurance. I think we can talk about the early sports specialization from these three very different perspectives. And just to kind of recuperate is when we see very true sports specialization, we see overuse injuries related to growth plates. And then sports that are more encompassing different aspects of the movement, we see less injuries.
Okay. And Holly, I know this is an area that you're passionate about. What would you add here?
Yeah, I would just actually take a step back and talk about how youth sports have become a $40 billion industry. Mm-hmm. Private venture capital has taken notice and really started investing in youth sports as a business. And prices have gone up for family investment 46% since 2019, which is just astronomical. So we've gone from, hey, let's, you know, teach our kids healthy habits to a play or pay to play model, right? Which is really exclusive and it really leaves out a big portion of our population. And so I think that it's tragic on a number of levels. And, you know, Zuzana, you already keyed into the nuance of it that, you know, different sports athletes peak at different ages, which really puts different pressure, right, on those athletes to really train hard and train long, you know, at different stages of their life. But in addition to those orthopedic and growth injuries, you know, my expertise is in mental health, and I think a lot about burnout. And burnout leading to dropout, right? And if we're trying to think of, you know, sports as creating lifelong healthy habits, when kids drop out at the age of 13 because they've already been practicing 6 days a week, you know, 11 months a year for 7 years, that's really problematic on a number of levels.
And how new is this, though? I mean, we've had... Kids have been really into sports. There's been these, you know, club teams for a long time. How new is the idea of specialization and how?
I mean, you know, that's a good question. And actually, if we look at kind of the goats of the world now, right, you know, a lot of them talk about doing a wide variety of sports growing up. So it's definitely a newer trend. But the financial pressures, those private equity firms, the year-round, you know, traveling 6 times a year to tournaments out of state. I don't know what you guys would say, but, you know, that really feels like it's taken a huge uptick in the last decade. I don't know. What do you guys think? Alyssa, maybe you.
Just over here nodding. Yeah, I think it's also an urban problem because, for example, I grew up in Kodiak, and you're in a town of 10,000 people. You're encouraged to do every sport. That's just what everybody did. Mm-hmm. And I know for a lot of Alaskan athletes, that's the same case. But if you do have bigger goals of pursuing a college scholarship, you know, I want to get college education is expensive. If I can play my sport an additional 4 years and my talents pay for that, that puts a lot of less stress on my family. So you're talking about these underprivileged families who need help that way, then okay, so now I need to focus my attention in my development and what can I do to get better? And I do think it perpetuates potentially a lot of unhealthy culture. And it's the responsibility of many adults in the room to be guiding kids through this process.
Yeah.
You know, just a couple of years ago, the NCAA went through a transition from collegiate sports being amateur to professional. And in many ways, like the idea of the athletes getting paid for their talents seems really holistic and wonderful. But when there's a lot of money to be made, not only in terms of a scholarship and getting your education paid for, but, you know, these collegiate athletes are getting paid as professional athletes. And, you know, if you become a professional athlete when you're 18, it just puts the pressure, like Alyssa was saying, to specialize earlier and earlier. So that transition it's called NIL, name, image, and likeness. And so now athletes own all of that. And, you know, I have a lot more to say about that, you know, but maybe we can
save
it for later. It's maybe a whole show, but I think it really, you know, that transition can drive the development leading up to those opportunities.
And yeah, Alyssa, how much do you see this with the kids you work with, the pressure and just the intention to specialize pretty early?
Yeah, I see it a lot. And I'll specifically point out where the sport that I work with the most, basketball and girls basketball in particular, has lost a lot of athletes due to volleyball players specializing in that sport at a younger age. And so that's really with what I do where I see that the most. And I know that basketball is kind of Alaska's sport, and it's probably trickling around different communities, but it's definitely a trend here in Anchorage.
And how do you help kids get beyond that?
I really encourage them to cross train. So what I do at the gym is we're training the athlete from a very physically holistic standpoint. So getting them out of the asymmetries that occur with sports. Zuzana talked about growth plate injuries earlier, and that is prevalent in sports, but in weightlifting and powerlifting, which are strength training sports, if you will, not that we're doing that at the gym, but those are sports relative to what I do. Those injuries are almost non-existent. So I think the power behind that thought alone, that the stronger you are, the more resilient you are, is where I encourage all athletes of not just basketball and volleyball, but to get in the gym. Is it fun? No, it's not as fun as going out and doing what you love and on the field, but an hour a day goes a really long way.
Okay. And do you see a lot of kids coming to your gym with injuries, at first?
Yes and no. I do see a lot of kids who are struggling with knee injuries, but the biggest part of what we try to do is catch them before anything happens from a prevention standpoint. Does that always happen? No. Especially the older an athlete is, they have definitely incurred at least an acute injury, but the prevalence of chronic injuries is a lot higher than I would like to see.
Okay. Yeah, Suzanne.
I would like to point out as well, just like what you said, Elisa, we have this amazing opportunity with, as coaches and strength and conditioning specialists, this huge opportunity to prevent injuries or maybe lower the risk of injuries if we know what we're dealing with and where we're going. So, for example, when we have girls going through their development, the age about 12 to 14, the early adolescence, is amazing opportunity to provide some kind of neuromuscular education, neuromuscular training, strength training, multiple direction changes to the athlete, to the young athlete, the possibly lower risk of injuries later on. And that goes back into that sport specialization. Let's see, we have sport, it's only working in one plane of motion, front and back, for example. We don't give them the chance to adapt the direction changes or the side-to-side movements. And that is probably one of the single most way that we can do to prevent or lower risk of injuries in the later adolescence.
So that's strength training?
Yes, strength and whole holistic training. So not just one type of training, but many different aspects of training. So like, for example, what Elisa is doing in her gym, if a person is doing basketball as their sport, she might add different aspects of different sport, maybe more like gymnastic body awareness into that kid's routine. And that is fantastic.
And not every kid is going to be on a competitive travel team. As we've been talking about, it's not ideal even for many kids probably. Can you, maybe Holly, you address this first. What's the value of recreational leagues and school sports?
Yeah, I mean, I am such a huge proponent of school sports. It just really lowers the bar, and takes away the barrier to entry. They're affordable. Many of them are inclusive. I'm a really big fan of the no-cut sports, right, where everyone can participate. I just love how kids get a chance to work together. They, get a chance to be teammates with someone that, might not be their peer on that really exclusive travel team. The benefits are so numerous, right? Between learning how to lose together, learning how to set goals together, learning how to support one another through hardship and adversity, right? It is just, it's huge. And, I think we're seeing funding problems, right, for middle school and high school sports, which is tragic. And for some reason, it feels like middle school sports are extra expendable, which middle school is developmentally an awkward age for kids, right? And that is really an important time for them to get out and move their bodies and play and laugh and work hard together. And I think we have a choice. Either we can, support inclusive school sports where everyone can participate, or, what's the alternative? What are those kids going to be doing, right, with that time? Getting into trouble or, just like looking at screens, scrolling on their phones. Like none of this is good for us, and it's not good for society.
Yeah. Susanna.
I would love to add 2 cents to what Holly said towards the middle and high school sports. It's incredibly important for musculoskeletal development to keep kids in sport because osteopenia and osteoporosis, which are bone diseases in a later age, is actually a disease of the childhood and adolescence. So we can think about middle school and high school kids, when they're participating in sports, they're putting their bone structure in bank. Mm-hmm. They're putting their muscle structure in their bank. They're putting their tendon structure and strength in the bank. And once we hit about 20 years old, we don't get any more. So we have this opportunity to do as much as we can in adolescence and early adulthood, and then the slide down is not going to be as steep. So that's my huge 2 cents to keep the middle school and high school sports and keep kids healthy and working out.
Okay. And yeah, I think we'll talk a little bit more about that soon. We've been talking about the physical side of keeping kids healthy in sports. Coming up after the break, nutrition. It might seem straightforward, but there's more going on with nutrition than just eating enough, including a condition called relative energy deficiency that's more common in young athletes than most parents realize. We'll get into that and more when we come back. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Annie Feit. We're talking about keeping kids healthy in sports, and I'm joined today by sports physical therapist Susanna Rogers, mental health therapist and former Olympian Holly Brooks, and strength and conditioning coach Alyssa Horn. Nutrition is such an important part of sports. I want to spend some time on that. Susanna, you kind of keyed us up there right before we went into the break, but talk a little bit more. How does nutrition play a role in the injuries you see in your clinic?
Well, it's incredibly important, and it's not just nutrition, but also the food intake. And I think in adolescents and young adults, that's more important. So many times when I see kids coming in with any kind of chronic, maybe bone stress injury, shin splints, they might be overtraining a little bit. They might not be getting enough calories in. And when, you know, my question usually when I see a patient is, what is your nutrition like? And then what is your food intake like? And there are two very different things. So you might hear that, yeah, my nutrition is really good. I eat a lot of vegetables. I eat a lot of salads. How much protein are you getting? Are you getting enough calories? Well, maybe not, because I'm not hungry. So what we see is, especially in endurance sports like cross-country running and skiing, I see a lot of kids that might actually fall into that deficiency of how many calories are coming in. And Holly will talk more about the relative energy deficiency in sports. Is we kind of count the calories in and calories out on the very basic level when it comes to food intake. But from the deeper side, from musculoskeletal perspective, what I see is when we have fewer calories coming in and more calories going out, we see sarcopenia, so muscle development slows down. The bone gets to break down a little bit. So kids like this are more prone to bone stress injuries. For example, we see a lot of shin splints, and they have a potential to develop into bone stress injury. We have to feed those. And then it doesn't matter whether your nutrition is perfect, whether you're getting your vegetables and protein and carbs. You just need to eat food to get more calories in.
Okay. Yeah. And so what, Holly, talk a little bit more about relative energy deficiency in sport and how common it is.
Yeah, REDS has become one of my passions, and you know, working with the athletic population, the prevalence of underfueling or fueling improperly is massive. it's hard to get a really good number on it, but we think that up to 67% of like adolescent athletes are underfueled in one way or another. And REDS in its basic form, it's a condition or a syndrome where you essentially have inadequate calories, right, and energy for what you're asking your body to do. And I think it's important to talk about, for one, how I often think about how puberty is a high-demand energy state. You need a lot of energy for the growth and development, but you have, you know, the food needs for your basal metabolic rate. What does it take to make your heart pump, right? And then what does it take for your activities of daily living? walking up and down the stairs at school? And then are you going to two-a-days, right, training? And so the caloric need is massive, right? And RED's, relative energy deficiency in sport, right, affects every system in the body. You know, it should be noted that it used to be known as the female athlete triad, right, which, you know, but since then we've learned that it affects all genders and, you know, it affects every system in the body. And so, you know, if there's a big caloric deficit, we in females or biological females, we can see amenorrhea, right, which is the loss of menstrual cycle and hormonal impacts. And that really affects that bone growth and development. So Susanna talked about the prevalence of BSIs, bone stress injuries. But when people are underfueled, there's also brain fog, there's reduced immune capacity. People are getting sick all the time. Irritability goes up. Anxiety goes up. The ability to adapt to your training, right? There are so many layers of deficit. And, you know, one thing that I think about often is that I think that diet culture and athletic culture have a lot of parallels, right? And there are lots of pressures for certain aesthetics, right? Like this athlete should look like this, right? And this athlete should be able to do that, right? And, you know, that is a hard intersection when it comes to trying to support our athletes going through puberty, right? Which is inherently awkward and, you know, involves a lot of changes in those athletes' bodies.
And Alyssa, is this something you see a lot with the athletes you're working with?
I work with groups a lot, so I think it's really important and powerful what Holly and Susanna do more on a one-on-one level, questioning kids and getting the more intimate knowledge of what they're going through. But I personally have gone through, I've had this happen to me before, and I'm 180 pounds, 5'10". That's not your typical build for an athlete who would go through this. I think we see it more in endurance type sports and things like that. But I would empower parents who are listening to, since they have the more intimate connection with their kids, of course, to be kind of paying attention to the things that these gals are talking about. Because my mom, she made dinner for us every night, you know, very healthy. I was practicing at a normal level and it still happened to me. I think I lost my period at one point for almost half a year. So this is not normal. And it's, you know, as a young lady, you don't necessarily want to bring it up, and I suffered 2 stress fractures from it.
Oh, wow.
And now, you know, in adult years, I'm noticing or realizing that there's so much that can be done, so many warning signs. So I just encourage the parents listening to this to pay attention to those with their kids.
Yeah, Holly.
Thank you so much for sharing, Alyssa. And I think it's really important to say that like REDS or disordered eating or eating disorders, it doesn't have a look, right? And, you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of my clients will say, I'm not skinny enough, right, to have REDS or an eating disorder or disordered eating. And that's not true. It affects like all different body types and shapes. And, you know, it really is like losing, you know, your menstrual cycle. It is a stress response, right? So your body is trying to conserve energy and it's shutting off functions that are not necessary, right? And so putting energy into having your heartbeat is more important than having a baby, right? And so that's what's happening, right, at that level. Biological males will have severe drops in testosterone. Right. So that is, you know, kind of that side of the equation. But I think it's really important to stress that REDS and disordered eating and eating disorders do not have one look. They do not discriminate. They affect all genders, all races, all shapes and sizes. And, you know, it's really a barrier to seeking help if someone mm-hmm. thinks that they're not skinny enough or not sick enough. And that's a huge issue.
And is it always something that is intentional on the athlete's part, or is it sometimes that you're just, you know, the fuel demands are a lot and you're just not getting enough.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So RED specifically, it definitely has an overlap with disordered eating or eating disorders. If we think about a relationship with food, it exists on a spectrum, right? And so I hate the word intentional, but you know, there are athletes out there who are intentionally trying to restrict, right? To change their body weight, shape, or size, right? So that's more along the lines of, you know, an eating disorder. There can absolutely be unintentional consequences and people just severely underestimating how much food they need in order to support what they're asking their body to do. And that can come in the form of not eating enough altogether. It can come in the form of not eating frequently enough. And a big trend that I am seeing is not eating enough carbohydrates, right? And so, you know, REDS is, in our current model, it's caused by LEA, which is low energy availability. But in the literature and just, you know, every day in my practice, I'm seeing what's called LCA, low carbohydrate availability. And, you know, there's been this big push on fruits and vegetables and overemphasis, in my opinion, on protein. Mm-hmm. And carbohydrates are absolutely necessary for sports. Yeah. You know, we need glycogen and carbohydrates have been demonized, right? They've been labeled as, hey, this is how you gain weight. And a lot of my clientele is terrified of eating carbohydrates, which is exactly the wrong message, right? And it puts them into REDS. Yeah. And then that can really exacerbate and accelerate into really severe eating disorders as well.
And what advice do you have for parents who are worried about this? And just in terms, I guess, of first of all, making sure their kid has enough food available to them during the day. But then just like watching for this to happen, because I would guess it's pretty subtle. It could be pretty subtle at first.
It can be subtle. And I guess I would start off by going upstream and talk about what is your family's relationship with food? Kids learn through modeling and they watch what their parents are doing, what their parents are saying, right? If the parents are being self-deprecating about their own bodies or talking about diets or talking about wanting to lose weight, in my opinion, that is the worst thing you can do to your child, right? Because then that idea that they need to change their body is imprinted, right, in their young brains. And that's really, really difficult. So number one, I would just really encourage everyone to look inwards at their own relationship with food and their own bodies. I come from an all foods fit model. And I think it's really important from, you know, well, to address your question of how do you support your kid, you know, I think it's a mixture of providing home-cooked meals and then also relying and utilizing shelf-stable prepackaged foods, right, to supplement for snacks. You know, especially female athletes who are working out hard, they should be eating a minimum every 4 hours to keep their body out of a state of stress. And so I think Costco is really our best friend, right? Yeah. And, you know, as an athlete and even in my office today, you know, I have cases of snacks. You know, if as a parent, you know, have a case of that Horizon chocolate milk, right? And some bars. You know, and things that your kids like to eat and they're going to gravitate to. So a mixture of, you know, good wholesome foods, but all foods fit and getting those bars in, right? Getting that chocolate milk, the bagels, you know, whatever it is, it's all really necessary.
You say chocolate milk and I think sugar, you can't do sugar, but you're saying go for the chocolate milk.
Sugar has been demonized. Sugar is a source of energy, right? And I'm not sitting here saying that we should just eat candy all the time, every day. But there is actually, you know, candy is quick fuel too, right? And so all foods fit. I like this paradigm of there are foods that are always foods and sometimes foods. And, you know, if we demonize a certain food, there is a large percentage of our population who will become obsessed with that food, right? So this is another rabbit hole, but there's what's called the binge restrict cycle, right? Trying not to eat, trying not to eat, trying not to eat, and then eating all the things. And then going through this shame spiral, right? And then restricting and then binging and restricting and binging, right? So, relationship with food, that's a whole show in of itself.
Yeah.
But all foods fit. We have to look at our own relationship with food and bodies, and kids are watching what we're doing.
Yeah. And you were saying girls need to eat, it sounds like girls need to eat a little more frequently than boys.
Yeah, you know, a lot of research is coming out specifically about female physiology, and our bodies are meant to have babies, really. I share that with all of my teenage clients. We get a good laugh, right? A lot of the research, so many people are into fasting, right? And a lot of that research shows that, you know, it does not have the same efficacy or effect on women's bodies and physiology than it does for men. Mm-hmm. We need more of a constant source of fuel in order to stay healthy.
Zuzana, in your clinic, do you, you're seeing this with kids, but can you talk about the difference between boys and girls? Do you see a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just to reiterate what Holly said, it's so, so important to have some kind of snacks. And we usually recommend maybe 100 calories before and right after practice. It's so easy to do because parents drive them to school and to practice. Eat when you're in the car. Mm-hmm. On the way there and on the way back. Gives you really quick energy recharge. So, talking about the differences between boys and girls, they're big. You know, I kind of jokingly say the boys stretch out first and then they fill, and the girls go the other way around. They might fill first and then they stretch out. So talking about girls through the early adolescence, what we see at about age 12-ish for girls is that dip in that neuromuscular control. We call it the adolescent awkwardness, you know, and suddenly you have a girl that starts to develop her sex characteristics, and suddenly she can't jump or she can't run as well. She can't catch the ball as well. And I think that is a really, really big opportunity for us as a personal trainers, gym owners, physical therapists, coaches, to pre-develop that in expectations of this dip to happen. And boys are a little bit relatively easier because they don't have this dip. They have this adolescent awkwardness when they get too lanky, maybe too inflexible because the bones grow so quickly. So we approach boys and girls in training a little bit differently. And there's a lot of research that's published about ACL injury prevention in adolescent athletes. And there are many training paradigms now that incorporate almost like a warm-up routine, multi-directional jumping routine before maybe basketball or soccer practice, or even we should see it in skiing practice, when the body gets stressed and neurologically ready for the training that comes after. And it's that is really, really big. What was I going to say? For boys, for example, I think adding strength training when the testosterone levels are starting to climb will give us amazing opportunity to develop them into healthy young adults.
And what age would you start strength training? Do you think kids should start?
You know, the most common answer in physical therapy world is it depends. It really depends on the maturation, right? So when we have a kid that is a little bit slower maturing, that maybe they're really lanky and their secondary sex characteristics are not developed yet, maybe we can not strength train them quite yet. But as soon as we start to see them developing, then it's the time, because we see the hormones coming and we should make the best use of the hormones. And the strength training really is one of the best forms of injury prevention.
Okay. We need to take another quick break here. So much of what we've talked about today is physical injuries and fuel, but there's another piece that doesn't always get enough attention, the mental side of youth sports. After the break, we'll talk about burnout, how to keep it fun, and what parents and coaches can do to support kids' mental health. Stay with us. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your guest host, Annie Feit, and I'm joined today by sports physical therapist Susanna Rogers, mental health therapist and former Olympian Holly Brooks, and strength and conditioning coach Alyssa Horn. This is a pre-recorded show, so you won't be able to call in with questions today, but we're glad you're with us. I want to keep going on the nutrition topic for a little while longer here and talk about iron levels. It's gotten more complicated since I was a teen participating in sports. Holly, can you talk a little bit about how important that is and what the different measurements are now?
Yeah, so a recent study actually found that up to 78% of female athletes and the control group had ferritin levels below 50. And if we think about ferritin, it is the iron your body is able to utilize and store. And so it's really connected to your energy and your sleep. If you have low ferritin, it can present as like brain fog and fatigue. And, we have a lot of athletes, especially female and especially menstruating athletes who lose a lot of iron through blood loss, experiencing low ferritin levels. And it's just something that is not screened for. You know, it's not part of a CBC, a complete blood panel. You actually have to ask for it. And then the normal clinical thresholds are very low. And so, you might not flag as being low or irregular, per what your pediatrician says. But for athletes, we need more iron availability. We need more energy for what we're asking our bodies to do. That number of what it should be varies on who you ask. But ideally, that number would be over 50, right? Which most female athletes are below that number. And so it's challenging, right? But something we should absolutely be paying attention to.
Yeah. And how do you, if you are low, which most, especially mm-hmm. female athletes are, what do you need to do to get that level up?
Yeah. I mean, food, of course, is a go-to. And, the hard part is that red meats and eating liver, right, is really your best source. And then, of course, beans and tofu and whatnot. But really, we need to be supplementing. And there are three different levels of supplementing. One is a pill form. One is a liquid iron, so actually drinking something, and then then there's an IV option as well. And so, based on the level, right, you can kind of choose, what route to take. Obviously, the IV is going to be the most effective in terms of getting it in quickly. The body takes a while to respond. Mm. And insurance carriers and whatnot are not as prone to wanting to cover, IV infusions, whereas other places, like Europe, for example, they've just kind of come around to that a little bit more. But we're all kind of walking around, and so many women are anemic and don't even know it.
Yeah, with the ferritin level being low too, I assume that makes you more prone to injuries, Susanna?
Yes, it can be because what we've seen in the clinic with low ferritin levels, athletes are more tired. And the brain fog, and they don't respond to training as well. They might be getting into overtraining or overreaching a little bit faster with low ferritin levels, mm-hmm. and their reaction times are a little bit slower as well. So when you see somebody, running on trails in the mountains and their reaction time is slower, there's a huge possibility of spraining your ankle. So it's all related.
I want to talk about mental health now. Big topic, but Alyssa, maybe I'll start with you. In your experience, how much time do coaches spend talking about the mental side of sport, and how much time do you think should be spent on it?
It's hard to say because I, you know, haven't gone around and interviewed a bunch of coaches, but I would say it's probably too little. And the ones who are succeeding at a championship level are doing it. I know the, for example, the boys coach who just won the 4A level in the state of Alaska, his entire team read a book together this year, and they do that every year. It's just part of their culture. And so much of the game is so mental that if we're not training, if we're only spending 0 to 15% of our time on the mental aspect, when really it's about 70 to 80% of the game, then I just don't think that math works out very well. So getting kids to be empowered to kind of take ownership and learning about this stuff on their own is great. You know, we can try to spoon feed them through practices and some intentional stuff on the side. But the more that they can invest in that themselves and learn, want to learn from themselves, I think it's where like the magic really happens.
Yeah. And Holly, what's your insight there? Do you?
Well, I just want to add some low-hanging fruit, maybe.
Yeah.
And say, you know, it might be intimidating for some coaches to address the mental side of sports or mental health, right? But one of the biggest protective things that I think coaches and, you know, physios and trainers can do is really see athletes as people first and players second, right? So if I think about, one of the most protective things, right? It's, you know, liking the person for who they are, not what they do, right? And so coaches who show interest in, you know, the athletes and get to know something about them, about their life off the field of play, right? That's hugely protective, right? And it sends this message to, you know, that player that I'm not how many points I score, right? My coach actually cares about me as a human first, right? And so I call that low-hanging fruit because I think that coaches are incredibly influential, right? Maybe some of the most influential people in our adolescents and our kids' lives, right? And getting to know them on a human-to-human level is really the best thing you can do, right? So investing in those relationships that aren't just talking about plays and technique and, you know, race tactics, right? But, you know, even doing things and incorporating things with your team that aren't related to your sport, right, can be really team building and getting a chance to see, you know, kids in different lights, I think is really wonderful.
And you, I've heard you talk about being focused on high engagement instead of high achievement. Can you explain that a little more?
You know, as so I often talk about how my work is at the intersection of mental health and performance, right? And we have, okay, what are the, you know, the you know, mental or cognitive tactics, right, for sport? But then we also have the mental health piece, which plays into it. And something I talk about in my practice a lot are process goals and outcome goals. And I think achievement really ties into those outcome goals. And there are a lot of coaches or even families and individuals who are obsessed with winning and, you know, stats and what team did you make, right? And that can be really reductive, right? And it can really create a vulnerability for that athlete and makes them kind of fragile, because if they have a poor game or they don't score a goal, or, you know, then who are they, right? They're nothing.
Yeah.
Right? And so I love this idea of how can we be highly engaged in our sport, but then, you know, try to create some low attachment to the results, right? How do we control our controllables? How do we focus on, you know, having fun and building a good team and really working hard, right? But not just focusing on stats and wins and losses and, you know, all of that. And so I think a lot of the drive needs to come from the athlete, right? And the coach can provide that setting where kids want to be there. They want to work hard, right? And I always think I kind of laugh when I hear about attendance policies. Because as a coach, my philosophy was always wanting to create an environment where kids wanted to show up. And I wasn't just threatening them saying, you have to show up. You know, I think it's a really interesting paradigm shift. Why don't you just create an environment where they want to be there, right? Yeah. Because that intrinsic drive and, you know, doing the sport because they love the sport is way more sustainable than doing the sport because kids get attention, right? Or they feel conditionally loved, mm-hmm. right, by how they achieve.
Yeah. Alyssa, I know keeping things fun is a big goal of yours. What? Why do you think that's so important?
That what you just said, Holly, is just so beautiful. How you wrap that up, it's amazing. I mean, that is our responsibility as the people who are in front of kids and creating these environments. They need to be safe. They need to be positive. They need to be uplifting. And the fun piece comes in when you get all these people who showed up to do this hard thing together. Now we're all smiling and laughing suddenly, and just that's where you build communities, you know, through suffering and laughter. So if you create this and make it that it's something that they want to look forward to, that's so powerful. And I think for a lot of kids, they see it, and even adults, you know, I work with adults too, we're conditioned to exercise in some capacity as being a form of punishment. I'm scarred for life when my coach used to say, get on the line, you know, and now for whatever reason, that I'm a little hesitant to run. But, you know, it's that type of thing. Like, let's make doing hard things something that is appreciated and that we look forward to doing. And that's a hard task to do. But the more that we can, you know, the more we're going to unlock greatness within ourselves and the people around us.
Yeah, and you know, adversity is a part of life. It's also baked into sports. How do you help kids, I guess, see the value in that?
Oh man, adversity is, and failing in adversity, kind of along the same lines. A lot of people seem to want to avoid it. They don't want to put themselves into situations that are uncomfortable where they're going to fail. I mean, this is uncomfortable, right? Where we're being recorded and whatever we say is going to be heard later. But it's so important to be willing to be uncomfortable because that's how you grow. That's how you get better. And the more that we can embrace that discomfort and learn through it and fail forward, the outcomes, not to, you know, focus on the outcome, like Holly said, that's a process that we're talking about, the mindset of failing forward, but the outcomes then are going to take care of themselves if we can just really lean into showing up, being consistent, being accountable. And that's really what the power of sports provides for us, is that community where that's embraced.
We talked a little bit about burnout earlier. How do you identify when it's happening with an athlete?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, how do you differentiate, you know, burnout from just having like a dip, right? Yeah. Or a bad week? And, you know, I think one of the differentiating factors is it situational, right? Did someone have a bad week because they're tired, right? Or it's finals week and they're just having a hard time showing up with 100%, right? That's maybe just a hard week. You know, burnout is, I feel like it's something a little bit more chronic in nature. It, you know, really includes a level of emotional exhaustion, right? Sometimes I see kids just have this like flat affect, right? Like just kind of nothing excites them, right? Nothing bums them out either. They just seem like this really low, dim version of themselves. You know, if they can't see any of their work turning towards progress or improvement, right? There's no intrinsic, no drive coming from them, right? But I really think it's, we have to look at the time frame, right? And then, you know, just kind of look at their relationship with sport. And I guess I will share one thing that I often share with clients. I talk about the rule of thirds, right? And I think it's really important to have athletes create realistic expectations, right? Because if their expectation is every day is supposed to be awesome and I am supposed to be improving in this linear fashion, and it's just not like that.
Yeah. Not real life.
So, no, it's not real life. And so the rule of thirds is this idea that, hey, maybe a third of your practices are going to be amazing, right? 30 of your practices are going to be neutral, and a third of your practices, like, you're not, you know, you're going to like come in below your expectations. And that's normal, right? But when two-thirds of your practices are horrendous or you feel, you know, flat, then maybe there's something going on. You know, and I will say from a mental health standpoint, we're always trained to look for physiological issues first, right? And so you know, maybe someone's presenting and it looks like burnout, but maybe it's actually REDS, right? Mm-hmm. And they're underfueled, right? And they're not getting enough food. And, you know, once you get enough nutrition into them, they perk up, right? And they're able to show up as themselves. So I think that's really important to mention. But, you know, figuring out how do you differentiate between a hard week and burnout, yeah. right? And I think that early sports specialization is really... really driving burnout. And that's why, you know, we need to have different seasons. That's why we need to have rest periods and off periods. More is not always better. You know, these two performance coaches who I love, they have this equation, stress plus rest equals growth. I'll say that again.
Yeah.
Stress plus rest equals growth, huh. right? In our hustle culture, you know, that's obsessed with optimization, we just think more is always better. Oh, we move the school start times up. Well, we're just going to insert all these morning practices. That was not the intention.
Yeah, that
was right. The intention was for our teens to get more sleep. That, I don't know. You know, it's working out for some. But I think it's really, really important to talk about, and I talk about rest as actually part of our performance, right? And we're not going to adapt and, you know, grow as an athlete without really prioritizing rest, really in the with the same importance that we do our performance and okay. our training.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I think we have to wrap it up from there. But if you all had one piece of advice you could give to every parent or young athlete in Alaska, what would it be? Who wants to go first? Susanna?
I think one piece of advice is let kids be kids. Let them play. Don't stress about competition and performance. Just let them play.
Great. And Alyssa?
My advice as not a parent, but understanding that it's probably one of the most difficult undertakings and unique undertakings a human can go through is to find your people who are going to coach you and be there in the fight with you and can help you with these difficult things that come up with your kids.
And how?
I would love parents to think about supporting their kids in sports, not obsessing about their kids playing sports. Our jobs as parents are to provide opportunities and, you know, figure out, let the kid figure out what sticks, right? And where their talents and love lies.
Okay, great advice from all three of you, Holly Brooks, Susanna Rogers, and Alyssa Horn. Thank you so much for being here today. If you want to learn more, we'll have resources linked on our website at alaskapublic.org. Crystal Hyde was our audio engineer. Rachel Cassandra edited the show, and our producer is Tobin Shelby. I'm Annie Feit. Thanks for listening.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.